That was Anthony Brown doing a rendition of John Coltrane's Afro Blue. And this is Wanda's Picks Radio, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. And we are having a special Hurricane Katrina anniversary commemoration program. And we're coming to you a little bit early because we've got folks in the studio that are there on the ground because Hurricane Isaac has touched down and is doing her thing or his thing. And so I want to welcome Malik Rahim into the studio. Malik Rahim is co-founder of Common Ground.
Yes, thank you, Yvonne.
Yeah, I'm so happy you could join us. You were telling me how you're the only one on your block with electricity because of your disaster preparedness. You've got this generator you're going to tell us about. And then Walimu Johnson is also joining us, a longtime activist, and the winds are blowing, but everything is still, you know, firmly grounded, which is really awesome. Good morning, Walimu. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Wanda. You're welcome.
Good morning, Walimu.
Good morning, Malik. How are you?
Oh, man, listen, I'm hanging in there.
Well, never seen that.
That's right.
Yeah. So I guess we should talk about what's happening now, and then we can, you know, sort of backtrack. It's been 7 years, and from what I hear, things aren't getting any better in New Orleans for the original people, so to speak, and people are still spread out in the diaspora post Katrina. So, Malik, why don't you tell us sort of what's going on where you are presently in Algiers?
Well, I'm gonna tell you, it's just deja vu for me and for our community. As a spiritual person, I always look at numbers, you know. When I was in the Panther Party, the shootout I was in was 7 years to the day after the Birmingham bombing. Now, again, 7 years to the day after Hurricane Katrina, here we are again going through the same thing. And the sad part about it is it's caused a large portion of our population in the same crisis. People that just spent everything on school supplies. So people with little now don't have nothing. And it's sad when you look around and you see so many people that is bunkered down in their house and didn't even have... don't even have enough candles, left on flashlights to last them through the night. And again, it's that selfish nature of us, of most people in this city. Those who had wealth and was able to leave, they have fled, you know, and just abandoned the rest. You know, it's nothing out there to say, well, hey, here's some flashlights, or some water, but you know, it's just a sad and a dismal situation. And then this hurricane is just it's traveling at such a slow pace. Cause see, by now Katrina has just about passed, but right now we haven't even seen the you know, the blunt of the hurricane yet. You know, so we're looking at it all day with this hurricane just lingering over us.
Walimu, what's going on in your part of town? Because you're actually on the mainland. You're not across the river.
Well, actually, I've been up literally all night long, mm-hmm. and I've been peeping out the window, although we had no power. A military vehicle came through one time, but in any event, I suspect that we have received much of the greater force of this particular hurricane. And, of course, as Malik said, there are people who some wanted to leave and couldn't leave and some left. But I suspect that many left, Wanda, because primarily Katrina being as traumatic an experience as it was forced people not to take a chance. And, of course, it's not that we should gamble with our lives, but there was always an indication that this was going to be a hurricane, no doubt, but nothing approaching the magnitude of Hurricane Katrina. But when you mentioned Hurricane Katrina at the outset, I had to reflect on some things that happened, because we can see that although we are dealing with a system that's extremely diabolic, they are also extremely scientific. So they use not only physical science to their advantage to destroy and perform genocide, but they also use social science. And I can see in their social science scheme of things that there is clearly a movement underway to gentrify the city of New Orleans and to prejudice those that are considered to be social undesirables. And, of course, we know that legally no one can justifiably say that you are not permitted to live in New Orleans. But when we understand the science, the social science behind it, then the objective is to make life so miserable and incomes so scarce that individuals who are not wanted are forced to go elsewhere because they're financially unable to maintain residency here in the city, and those who can maintain residency in the city have to make a choice between paying rent or buying the necessities of life, such as food, clothes, and other items that are needed, medical attention, etc. And we find, too, that in what is called New Orleans East, which that's a name that just came up just a few years back because it's all been New Orleans all along, but this is a way of divide and conquer on the verbal side. And in New Orleans East, you have primarily the people of, let's say, high Netherman content, highly concentrated in the lower, what is the New Orleans East area. And they, for the most part, set themselves apart from others, although they don't verbalize it, but the old saying, action speaks louder than words, is in fact at work here. And it doesn't mean that all blacks in all East New Orleans have this attitude, but the fact that it exists tells us that the rule of divide and conquer has continued to be played in favor of
alive and well.
It's not just a local situation, it's global. And I was blessed to be able to attend a Fourth World Movement function just this past Saturday. Mm-hmm. And it was very touching to see individuals across all lines, religious, academic, financial, ethnic, racial, all lines working with unity of purpose to help create a better world. In fact, when I was on the panel for the U.S. Social Forum in 2007, the motto was that a new world is possible, a new United States is necessary. And there are people, in fact, working toward this end, but the major problem has been there is not an umbrella under which we all can come together to exchange our views and work together to strategize as to how the best way, I should say, to approach this situation. But in any event, I do see this coming together, and I do see this gentrification at work regardless of what politicians may say. In spite of what they might say, we see it at work here.
Right. Yeah. I was reading this really insightful article from the New Orleans Tribune. Yeah, Herb told me about it last month, and he actually has a piece in this edition of the paper talking about the 40 years of solitary confinement that the Angola 3 have experienced. When was the anniversary?
April 17th.
Right. You were there, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I saw your picture. Yeah.
Oh, wow. I hope I didn't break anybody's camera.
No. Yeah. Because on the and then, Albert's hearing that happened, and then I was asking King, he's trying to call in and he's not having much luck. I was asking King about what was going on with the case. Yeah, do you want to talk about that, Walimu and Malik?
Well, this is what...
Go ahead.
Well, I was physically at the hearing,
mm-hmm.
and I have mixed feelings. First of all, I'm very optimistic in one sense because for years, Judge Brady, the federal judge that's presiding over the case, has made it clear that he intends to free these people as long as within legal bounds, and he has attempted to do this. But we have an attorney general here who finds that it's not necessary to put the bedclothes over the head anymore because he can just come out right and let it be blatant client action. And he has opposed everything, even to the extent of violating the very laws he was sworn to uphold by claiming that if the judge allowed Albert Woodfox to be released on bond, then his office intends to prosecute Albert Woodfox for a number of rape charges, which he had never had a rape charge anyhow. As a matter of fact, Buddy Caldwell, being the attorney general, has enough legal knowledge to know that even if such case existed, then the statute of limitations had expired long ago. This man has been in solitary confinement 40 consecutive calendar years, and, of course, he's been incarcerated even longer than that. And the reason for his and Herman Wallace's incarceration is the same as the reason that King, when he was in Angola, was locked up in isolation for 29 years, no other reason than the fact that they were Black Panthers. And Warden Burl King himself stated that these men could have been off lockdown, but the idea was they want these men to repudiate their allegiance with the principles of the Black Panther Party. And when we say Black Panther Party, many people use the word game because they think it's a group of blacks getting together to destroy all non-blacks or primarily Caucasians or whatever. But the Black Panther Party consists of members from various ethnic and racial groups. So it's not a question of racism. It's a question of oppressed people coming together to resist a common force with a common cause because they understand that we can't allow these various differences to keep us apart because oppressors have one thing in common. They have a number of differences. They don't all have the same academic standing. They don't all have the same religious conviction. They don't all have the same financial standing. But the common factor is they are working with unity of purpose to oppress the less fortunate on this planet Earth. And if people can come together to create these conditions for those of us who are victims of this oppression, then we have an obligation, not just as a choice, we have an obligation to set aside whatever differences we might have to resist. Because if we continue to allow this to go the way it's going, and of course I'm convinced that the oppressive scheme is going to fail ultimately, but if we allow it to continue on and on, there will be a point at which we would have a million and one regrets and won't be able to do one thing about it because we will see our grandchildren, our grandchildren, and our great-great-grandchildren dealing with something worse than we have to contend with right now. I get carried away, Wanda, so you know how I am, so I'm letting my leaf talk a while.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to tell you why Limoy basically said it all. In Louisiana, you know, it have always been the thing that we was going to, the state, that the powers that be, was going to crush what they call Black Pantherism, you know, and it's because of that Black Pantherism that they are still in solitary confinement. I don't have no faith in the court, you know, because what they're doing is using the war nutrition, and that is don't care what they win, what victory they win in court, that they're going to appeal it and keep them locked up. I believe that the only way that they're going to get out, it's a court of public opinion, and that is that the people, not only throughout Louisiana but in the United States, but people throughout the world need to put this nation on notice that how can you look at talking about being a champion of human rights when human rights is being denied blatantly throughout the United States and in particular here in Angola. We're talking about no longer young men. We're talking about elderly men that are now spent 40 years in isolation, you know. And if that's not cruel and unusual punishment, then what is? You know, we have to break this, you know. I mean, Buddy Caldwell is also, his funding is coming from the Tea Party. You know, so we have to look at this. We have to look at the political dynamics that allow these things to happen. And one of the things that I've been trying to do so far unsuccessfully is to push the agenda that, hey, it's time for us to push a recall of Buddy Caldwell, to get him out of office, you know, and make sure that, that never again such monsters be allowed to hold political positions. But as it relates right now, you know, we'll just go from one to another, because Cody, who was the attorney general before him, he wasn't that much better. He wasn't any better than Buddy Caldwell. So it's that whole mindset. It's that whole mindset of, hey, we got to crush that Black Pantherism. It's because of that that Common Ground have been disintegrated the way it has. It's because of that you constantly see individuals that are saying that, hey, I will not get involved in no political action while I'm incarcerated or on these streets, you know, because of the fact that this is what they hold in front of them, that if you get involved, this is what's going to happen to you, you know, and it's sad that this is allowed to continue. You know, it's been trusted too long. You know, these men, you know, need to be out. Not, they should have been out yesterday. You know, and so I don't have no faith in the court system. I don't have no faith in this government.
Well, King has joined us after trying really hard to get on the air. Good morning, King.
Good,
how are you?
Good.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, everybody. How is everybody?
Okay.
All right.
Peace, brother King. All is well.
All right, all right, all right, Wally Moo. How you doing? How you doing, Malik? Everybody.
All right.
So King, we were just talking about the 40th anniversary, which was April 17th, and Wally Moo, I was telling him, I was like, oh yeah, I saw you on the steps, and Malik, were you there too?
No, I wasn't. My health didn't allow me to go.
Yeah, how is your health? Are you better?
Well, I have my good days and my bad.
Yeah.
But, you know, by the grace of the Most High, I've been able to persevere.
Right. Well, we're happy about that. So, King, so how are you doing in Austin, in the diaspora? You're one of those Katrina survivors that is no longer in New Orleans.
I'm all right. I mean, survived the water, and now I'm surviving the heat. So, I mean, you know, out of the water into the heat. So I just got to put up with this for a minute, stew a little bit, you know. Otherwise, I'm okay. Still traveling. Sorry, I couldn't get in on a call earlier, and I missed a lot of the things that were being said. But I imagine, you know, since this big, long, you know, anniversary of Katrina, I imagine we're talking about that. And a few other things. I did come in with Malik. I caught the last part of Malik's conversation, but otherwise, I'm here.
Yeah. Well, as the only liberated member of the Angola 3, do you want to add anything to what Malik was talking about with regards to Albert's case and the hearing and Herman's case?
Well, yeah, you know, I really wish it was possible that you would have one of the lawyers on here, could have gotten one of them to be bold enough to come on your show, be sensitive enough to come on your show and talk about just exactly what is going on. I don't want to, you know, give the impression to make, give any idea that there's a clash. It is not, but I think there is a matter of being proactive and not reactive. You know, I think we have, there are many people who come up with a lot of theories as to what needs to happen as to, you know, but Buddy Caldwell, to me, is really a minute problem if we had lawyers who was willing and would be proactive in pursuing certain things. For instance, like, I'm told that, you know, since the hearing, which was what 3 days of hearing, there was a certain amount of time, and I'm sure someone has already covered this, but I'll just be brief. the stenographer had a certain point of time to get these documents out, you know. The court, you know, gave them a directive to do this. Of course, the court always is lenient. They give more time. But you're working with a stenographer who is also an appendage, a part of the prosecution, just an extension of the state, and they're going to take time, you know. They're going to take their time, and if the lawyers don't push the judge to push the stenographer, all that crap about, you know, well, we don't want to make her mad or him mad because they will take more time. Harmony Albert is mad. We are mad. You know what I'm saying? Quote. I mean, they only worry about making the stenographer mad. What about Harmony and Albert? So these are the things that I don't know. I think, you know, not being proactive, like we should. Of course, like I said, people can come up with all kinds of, you know, means and other, you know, things that and focuses that we can do that can add to it. But there is no one thing, I think, that can be done except we be... That is the, you know, the grassroots, be proactive at all times because if the lawyers are not proactive, they're not being proactive enough. The grassroots should be always proactive, you know, and they should not see this as our being separate or enemies, but we are allies and we are trying to achieve the same purpose, but we can't go down the road that they're going, the passivity road, you know, that reactive road. We have to be proactive at all times because this is a high-profile case, you know, and there's no such thing as it's not going to be tried. The public, you know, public opinion does matter. It sways the court, I know, in my own case. You know, so, and all that talk about making the judge mad, the judge is on our side, always been on our side. And it is just this little small minute. They have put a little man in a huge place, you know. I'm talking about Buddy Caldwell, a little man in a big place, and he don't know how to operate. And he, you know, I think the lawyers need to be the one to guide him, and we can't do it. He's not going to hear us. Actually, he's not going to hear the lawyers' news because they seem to be scared of him. And I'm sorry for saying that. If I offended anybody, I know that lawyer will be get offended by me saying this, but so what? Mm. Anyway, that's my point.
Wow. Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes. We can hear you, Alima.
Well, let me say this, King. I'm glad that you finally had a chance to come in because before you did manage to get through, Wanda had said you were making a number of unsuccessful attempts to get in. And what I wanted to add to it is that although at the time this particular incident occurred that had these people on lockdown, King was not even physically in Angola prison. But when he did reach Angola, by virtue of the fact that he was a Black Panther member, he was held for 29 years in isolation along with Albert Woodfox and Herman Wallace to investigate his participation in that particular incident. I'm involved in something that I'm not even there because of the fact of what? My political persuasions? Well, that's all I wanted to throw in.
Thank you, Wallace.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
So, in the city of New Orleans and in the Gulf region in general, over the past year, I know last year on the anniversary, the police that shot, not the police, but the the hired soldiers or whatever, the hired militia killed those people crossing the bridge. They were sentenced. That the verdict came through. That's what one of the big things that happened last year, and there was a march. And then, so I was wondering, is anything planned for? Well, actually, nothing could be planned because there's a hurricane.
Wait a minute, Wanda. I want to listen. That wasn't nothing but a fraud.
Oh.
No, it wasn't nothing. It wasn't nothing out of that. I mean, listen, we had vigilantes over here. Not one vigilante have ever been convicted of anything. We talk about this, but what happened to Henry Glover's skull? Where is his skull? What happened to
I'm
this man's skull?
I'm glad you mentioned that, Malik.
There's nothing about that. This has nothing been but a joke. That's all it has been is a joke. You see, everybody that have been a person that has been convicted is nothing but low level a pawn. And it's always in chess that you're sacrificed a pawn to save a knight. You know, and that's the further they have been. They've just been pawns. You know, you have to look at why did this happen? And that's what people are failing to see, that Homeland Security, as it used Katrina as the first testing ground, that New Orleans is now a fusion center for Homeland Security. And that as long as it's that, and as long as that right wing is in control of it, we all are just one step from being incarcerated or murdered under the justification of security. That's why I refuse to attend any of those rallies for it. We done had all these damn conferences in New Orleans, and having nobody really touched what happened here after Katrina. You know, it's a bunch of bullshit. That's the way I feel about it. It's just been a bunch of bullshit, all those rallies. You see, because if you just rally, and after the rally, you go home and do what? You know, so again, it haven't been nothing because nothing has changed. Nothing have changed politically, socially, or economically. It is still the same way. We're only one step from going right back in the chains right here.
Well, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to die. I ain't going back in no chains. And I think there are a whole bunch of people. And I hear you, Malik, and you're right. Mechanisms are being put in place that can cause that, but ultimately, it is up to us to determine whether or not we're being changed. We could just look at it, dissect it, and just say, well, we're all going to die. Or we could just continue to struggle. And I think the desired impact and the efforts that we have, because we are struggling and we continue. This is not a defeat. This is never the defeat. I don't want to see that being a situation where we are defeated and nothing will change. I think I'm a proponent of cause and effect. I believe when you throw a pebble in the pond, you're going to get ripples. And you might not see the ripple effect, but keep doing what you're doing. And one generation may not, and I'm sorry, but that's where it is. We live in a world where there are collateral damages, and we have to acknowledge and admit that. And it depends on who has the power. This is why we have to struggle. This is why we have to achieve equality, because when you don't have it, these are the type of things that you succumb to. These are the type of things that you are subjected to. And so this is where we have to focus our attention. It is a much bigger picture than New Orleans. It's a much bigger picture than Homeland Security. It is the United States of America. It is the government that is not, I'm not talking about people. I ain't talking about, it is the way this U.S. government is set up. It is set up the way to design. Look at all the stuff that has happened, in the last 4 years or so with regards to voting. And I'm not saying I don't vote. I don't do this. But there are people that do vote. You have to, because if there wasn't any of this, that we probably would be falling in a hole where we were. But what have the Republicans did? While we slept, while we were reactive, not being proactive, they have implemented laws in every state, 47 states, suppressing the votes to make sure a person of benevolence, or make sure a person who might get in that will give up some breathing room to somebody who won't take breathing room for themselves, they figure out a way to keep that person out of office. We have to continue whatever. We have to keep throwing the pebbles in the pond, even if we don't see the ripples or don't see the waves. And I think this is what we have to do. And I agree, all these mechanisms are in place. It's a fact. But we can't let that defeat us. We can't give in to it. We have to do more than just talk about it. We have to set things in place to put our own ideas. Ideology is a hell of a thing out there. It is the ideology that changes the world. I am letting you know, other things change the world too. But I am telling you, when you make people believe a certain thing, it might be a lie, but to them it's the truth, and they're going to operate on that principle. And this is what we have to understand. We have to evolve to the point of understanding what is going on around us, except having a superficial knowledge of what is going on in our own environment. We have to look at the entire picture, go beyond the shores. And I'm raving, but sometimes, it's like that. And I apologize if I seem to rage.
Don't apologize for bringing what's necessary, brother. Lord, indeed, people should apologize.
Because I don't apologize
for
the range I'm in, and I want to keep it.
Malika, I was just when King was speaking about, you know, we have to do something, and Common Ground, you know, first responder, 7 years ago, before the municipalities, you know, sort of stepped up, and they never quite stepped up enough, and so, you know, Common Ground, you know, collective established, you know, institutions to help people, you know, the hospital, well, not the hospital, the clinics that you established, and, you know, the one that's there in Algiers has been, you know, its own entity, its own, you know, business now and going strong for a while now. And I'm wondering how healthcare is now in New Orleans. I know Charity Hospital was shut down, and, you know, it served, you know, the greater population, not just in New Orleans, but, you know, in the diaspora, you know, right in that region, and people are coming to Charity from Mississippi. And I was wondering, you know, sort of now, has the healthcare, you know, system sort of, does it meet the needs of the population? And then you mentioned earlier, you know, that the city government, once again, was not proactive in responding to the needs of its poor populations with regards to, you know, giving them things like flashlights and radios that don't need electricity, and make sure they have food and water and those kind of things, and if they wanted to leave, you know, helping them with the evacuation. So I was wondering if you could talk about that too as well, since you all are right there on the ground, you and Walimu.
Well, I'm going to tell you, Wanda, listen, if I could get a generator, my generator is powerful enough to cover a couple of my neighbors' homes to get them some bait. So what could this city do? What could this nation do? Because, again, we are not talking about no poor. We are not in hate. This is supposed to be America. It isn't supposed to be that a Category 1 hurricane will come here and have this type of effect only because of the fact we allow it, that this government is allowing it, because they know that it's so many people that are saying that they know that after this, they're going to leave. They're going to say, well, man, I'm not going through this no more. That's the thing that they're doing. It's a war of nutrition, and they are beating us down. You know, Common Ground, they did a job on Common Ground. You know, I mean, from Brandon Darby to everyone, to all these so-called politicians, both racists and those old black slave owners, they have done a job on us. I've just mended all the grievance I had with the health clinic, that now we are working together to make sure as soon as this hurricane passes, we will be providing health services in the community. I'm speaking with some former Common Grounders right now to make sure that after this hurricane passes, that we start being able to offer the basics of survival, food, water, you know, repairs on their homes. We're hoping to be able to start doing this to make sure that those who are least capable of recovering, that they are also stand a chance, and to encourage people to don't allow this to be a reason for you to leave. Don't let nobody force you out of this city. You dig? Because New Orleans is a unique city. People don't live in New Orleans. New Orleans live in the people, and it's all about African American culture. You know, and again, we need to understand that. We need to make sure that we are here. You dig? They could have put people in the Superdome. They could have used the convention center. But why they didn't want to do it? Because they're so busy worrying about a fucking Super Bowl. That's the reason. That's the reason why people is living in, is suffering right now, living in sometimes houses that this Dalek is saying to survive the hurricane. There's no reason for that. There's no reason for it. They tore down all the projects. which was the safest building that poor people had. They tore them all down. Now people is living in these little flimsy houses with lures and roofs right now. You know, I mean, and nobody seemed to care. Not this city. Nothing was done. It wasn't like it was an earthquake. We had warning that this was going to happen. And, again, we didn't heed this warning. Again, those who could, they left. And those who was left here, they were just, once again, abandoned. Because you can't tell me that you didn't abandon them if you didn't try to help them. You know, and that's what's going on. What I ask is that anybody with healthcare experience or part of a healthcare profession, and after this hurricane, if you can come down, if not, send some supplies so that we can make sure that the basic health is being provided for. As long as I'm alive and that clinic is open, I'm gonna make sure that it's provide service. This generator that I have at my house, soon as this hurricane is over, gonna be at the health clinic to make sure that health clinic is capable of operating. We're going to try to set up some distribution centers so that we can make sure that we can start supplying, start providing some of the basics, you know. And we're going to let them know that whatever your plan is, that we're going to be right there. We're going to be that wrench in your machinery. I wouldn't say what kind of wrench, but we're going to be that wrench in your machinery. We're going to be there. We're going to be providing service. It ain't going to happen like it happened last time. It ain't going to be no fucking vigilantes in Algiers this time. Because if they are, they ain't going to be met with just one or two of us. So, again, we are here. We're going to be here. We're going to be providing the services that is needed for the upliftment of our entire communities. And we're going to make sure that working in solidarity with others, you dig, that we're going to make sure that people are provided those basic needs.
Walimo, I think I heard you, but Herb is on the line. Parnell Herb is joining us. Good morning.
Hey, Herb, how you doing? Peace,
Herb.
All right. Yeah, everyone's voice. Yeah. Nice to hear you.
Yeah. So you just
excuse me, Wanda. Yes. I got some people. I don't know why they're out here, but some of my neighbors is at my door. I'm gonna have to jump off the phone to go see what's going on.
All right. Cool. Well, thank you for joining us, and we'll check back in with you.
All right. Listen. Let y'all take care. All right.
All right. Take care, bro.
All right. Peace.
Okay, peace. So Herb, you have a piece in the New Orleans Tribune, but you turned me on to the story by Lavelle last month or the last issue about gentrification. So why don't you tell us what's going on in your neighborhood right now? You sent me an email about staying dry and staying well.
Yeah, well, I don't know what's going on in my neighborhood. I just woke up. The power's off.
You're not underwater, so that's good.
Well, let me look at the window and make sure, but I think we're all right. It's a category of one, not the thing. It's a category of one, so this will consider a dry run. We consider this a wet run to get us ready for whatever may come after in a few. But from all indications, everything's all right, other than power being out. Most people I talk to plan on staying here, even after dealing with the aftermath. And I, too, plan to stay unless it looks like the power's going to be out for an extended period. Then I'll have to get my sister and bring her out of town. But otherwise, it's just a matter of until things dry out, get out there and assess the damage and pick up from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you relocated back to New Orleans after living outside New Orleans after the hurricane. You went to Texas, I believe?
That's right. I was in Houston. I stayed in Houston for 5 years, and I came back maybe 2 years ago. And I'm really not extremely pleased when I got here, but you know, this is where I am now, and I'm going to do whatever while I'm here and make plans to do something else later on.
So what kind of organizing are you working on presently?
Well, we still got a lot of stuff going on with Angola 3. That's my main focus right now.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing other stuff. We're dealing with one of the things we're doing is the city is changing. Gentrification is kicked in full time. And it's, well, again, you know, I said it 7 years ago when they flooded us out. It was an act of nature, but man appreciated it. It took full advantage of it. Once they got us out of there, they did what they did to keep us out. There are many people who would still love to be back in New Orleans, and they can't get back because there's no place for them to come back to. It was an act of nature, but man took advantage of it. I said, man, I look at the white man, took advantage of it. They ushered us out the front door. They brought Latinos in the back door to do the work to help rebuild the city. And now it's got to a point where they're bringing in, the white professionals to rebuild the city. But when they say rebuild the city, my question is, rebuild it for who? You know, they're rebuilding for themselves, not for us. Okay, I just opened the door and I'm going to close it. The wind is pretty rough out there. But anyway, so yeah, I'm back and I'll be here. Maybe, you know, be anyway.
Yeah. Walimu, do you want to tell us what, you know, any particular organizing? Because I know you're really connected to the Ashe. And they usually, you know, they do a lot of cultural, political work. And I remember one Kwanzaa that you were there, and you were the special guest speaking.
Well, to say what particular organization, Wanda, I guess you can say I'm like the red blood cells that go through the vein.
Uh-huh.
Because I have to carry a little oxygen and drop it off where it's needed. Then I pick up a few impurities and release them from the body where it's necessary.
Mm-hmm.
So I won't limit myself to a particular organization because I move into various areas to see what I can contribute and what I can absorb from those organizations to pass on to others. And, of course, I'm being general now, but you understand where I am with that. So it's not
right.
I belong to anything acting under the colors of an organization. I'm a part of everything, but I don't belong to anything. And what I mean by that is I'm concerned about everything that's happening to everyone, regardless of social status. But I can't swear allegiance to something because we're dealing with a system that has a way of charging a group with the actions of an individual. And I don't want anybody to be charged unjustly with any actions on my part or anything that I might say or do, really, as far as that goes. But what I would really like to say when you mention, you know, health care, there are a few, relatively few, I should say, positively motivated individuals who have established community health clinics, and there's a group called the Round Table in which individuals from various organizations and concerned individuals, too, get together to express, you know, their views, exchange ideas about what each organization is doing and how can each organization help to work along with the other organizations because it affects us all in common. So that's some effort there. But as far as the major health situation, there's a deliberate design to prevent the needy from having access to meaningful health care. As a matter of fact, people have been saying about, well, Charity Hospital, Katrina knocked that out. Katrina did not knock out Charity Hospital. Charity Hospital was deliberately flooded, and, of course, when people entrust you with information, it would be a violation to say such and so told me thus or so. But I know that I'm not lying, and others know that I'm not lying. There were hospital employees at Charity that went into the basement and got out what little water there was in the basement. And the second time they came, some people with suits on, asked them what are they doing, and they explained that they were assisting, you know, to help get the hospital functioning again, and they told them don't come back. And when they went back the third time, the place was flooded because whoever these people were, no doubt had some influence to have whatever areas turn on their water inside that building, and it was really flooded then, and they were threatened that if they were to come back there, that they would have to face criminal charges. So the employees, the ones that were there trying to help, did not go back. So that was deliberate design because Charity Hospital was more or less the backbone for medical attention relative to the less fortunate in life, and the governor, Bobby Jindal, here in Louisiana, has made it a point. It's not the individual. He is the representative of a cancer of which many other political figures are parts, and they are parties to the crimes against humanity perpetrated by that social cancer, and they are deliberately taking away funds that are needed to assist the less fortunate in obtaining meaningful medical health care. So we have to be mindful that when we say in health care, we got to go beyond the community clinics and see that we can develop community clinics all we want to. If we don't understand the wider picture, the people that control the medical facilities that make things available, they'll do one of two things, either sabotage the movement or make it so high that you wouldn't be able to offer the assistance to set out to offer in the first place. But I commend those who are at work trying to make a meaningful difference.
Right, yeah. So what happened, Walimu, to those patients who were killed when the flood was happening, and certain medical personnel took it upon themselves to just selectively kill people, you know, give them lethal injections? What happened to those people that killed them?
There was a criminal trial. As a matter of fact, the guy that Malik mentioned earlier, Gus, no, it wasn't Gus at all, but Forty was Attorney General, and of course they orchestrated a scheme where the nurses, the medical personnel would go through a charade of a trial, and ultimately they wind up back at home anyhow, and they became heroes, more or less. Some might have, and I can't say I know that some were euthanized. I don't know, but from all indication, in fact, the evidence shows that there was some euthanized. But,
oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, it's proven that they killed people.
Yeah, they killed.
There's no question that people were killed. They killed people.
They made it appear that they were performing an act of mercy because it was such a hopeless situation. So many of the people, jurors and others, felt like, well, they shouldn't be penalized for good intentions. Well, the old folks used to have an old saying, that hell is founded on, the road to hell is founded on people with good intentions. So you might have had good intentions, but you should have been professional enough to take this higher and higher and force a situation wherein there would be some assistance given to these people. But the idea is they'll assist those that they desire to assist. Otherwise, they'll flush the toilet and let them go down the social toilet also. Common practice. But there were people actually killed up at Baptist Hospital on Napoleon Avenue in New Orleans.
King, did you want to add something to that?
No, I was just, what he's saying was, you know, required a comment. And I mean, just a output. Sorry about it, but yeah, I was agreeing with the thing that he was saying with regards to, you know, we can do what we want, but there are people who, unless we actually get control of the, you know, the procedures and the mechanism to make these, whatever we, you know, will desire to do operate, we could make all of, you know, but that don't stop us from trying to, because when we do see anything, we raises the bar a little bit, in a sense, you know. We make it known, you know, that there is a dissent, and when we make this known that there's a dissent, and that can be, collective dissent, it can have a hell of an impact. But by the same token, while we are, you know, making this dissent, we have to be mindful that we can only, right now, as long as we have got a dissenting voice, we are good. When they take that away from us, then it's terrible. But we got, as long as we're able to dissent, we can make it known what is going on, and you can bet one thing. At some point, we'll, you know, we just have to continue, you know. And if, I mean, sometimes, like I said, we have to rave, but then there's a point where we have to do more than rave at some point. We have to get things done. We have to, you know, we have to get things done. And when I say get things done, it is not, you know, in a, you know, threatening mode or anything like that. When I say get things done, we do the things that are necessary, like other people do, to make sure that we have continuity in what we do. Because everyone can make an attempt to evolve a situation, but very few people stay there to evolve it. The key is, I think we have to make sure that we're doing this. So I was just agreeing, you know, with what Walimu was saying, you know, that we just have to, you know, understand who controls and who owns, because we can wind up in the same situation. We can get all these things, implement all kinds of stuff, but if we are not really, you know, if we're not going to follow through with it, then it falls back into the hands of inadequate individuals who really don't care about anything except a profit, you know.
Yeah, I was thinking when you said, when you were talking that, I think what you're saying as well is that we need to organize and stay organized, you know, because
you can't accomplish anything
if you're not organized, any kind of thing that's sustainable and also has a larger and widespread impact. Because if I'm doing my thing over, you know, here, and you're doing your thing over there, and they're both, you know, good work, but we're not linked, then the cumulative effect is fragmented. So, you know, I think Kwame Ture, you know, formerly Stokely Carmichael, talked about organizing. And with that said, I was thinking, you know, this month is also, you know, Black August. And, you know, a lot of great things happened this month, as well as, you know, we lost, you know, significant comrades this month. So I was wondering if you want to talk a little bit about Black August and about you know, African resistance, Pan-African resistance, and maybe call some names of some of our comrades who are no longer with us, like, you know, Geronimo Jijaka, who was a Louisiana, you know, native.
Well, yeah, you know how Black August gets its name, you know, from the time the 70s, especially when Jonathan was killed in the Marin County Courthouse, in that, you know, alleged attempt to get William Christmas and all of them out of prison, and then later on George was killed, and that prompted the Attica, what they call Attica Rebellion, and so forth and so on. But anyway, Black August emerged from that, and I found out, I learned, Wanda, that, you know, August was a month, I think it's a pretty good month to, you know, to focus on. Of course, every month is a good month to focus on. But when you look at the month of August, and I know you have that data, I don't, you know, my memory isn't too well these days, but it's good enough to notice that a lot of things occurred in August, dating back from the 18th century on up to now, or perhaps further back, that took place in August. So August is a very significant month, and when people, you know, when it emerged, you know, to coincide with struggle, you know, this is what August has shown, that the experience of African American in America, that is, has been one, you know, one that took place mostly, the big events, the happening occurred in the month of August. And I don't have a calendar here before me, but yeah, I remember seeing that. So August is a very significant month, and there are many, like I said, many things happening in August. And one that is most, you know, prevalent to me is the fact of what happened with Comrade George when he was murdered. And a year prior to that, his brother Jonathan was killed, a year and a day to be exact, before he was. So those are the two comrades that I really, you know, remember most with regards to how it actually began, you know.
No, but I was just saying, even if the person didn't pass in August, we lost some comrades in 2011.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to give you an opportunity to remember them like Geronimo, who is a good friend of yours.
Well, you called his name, and I had...
No, I thought
you
might
want
to say
name,
something.
Which, well, I think about him. It's been a year in now, a year in about 2-3 months, you know, and, I mean, it didn't seem like a year had went so fast. And, of course, Geronimo, I had just seen him 2 weeks prior to that, to his dying. So his death really, you know, impacted me. And I hear myself saying sometimes, damn, G, why you died, you know. I hear myself saying that, but he had to go on and die, man. Like I said, G tried to make a difference, and he was one of the ones that it's not that I didn't want to talk about him, but I remember him as being the last time I saw him, and I never forget what he said. No, I heard you driving. I'm like, man, that's the freest thing in the world to be driving. I drove from California. You all the way to Louisiana, man. Man, I feel free. I know how you feel. I said, yeah, bro. You know, I said, yeah. That was one of the last things he said to me. So every time I'm on the road now, I remember G. I think about G. But I think about G all the time, not just on the road, because he was a friend. But I think of G as, like I say, he's Trenches, and he's, you know, he lives in us. He lives in the memory. Like I said, and I can only remember him in one way. It's so many others. But I focus on him. I remember him because he tried to make a difference. And a lot of people didn't know about it, and he wasn't the one that stand up and shout and talk about it. But he tried to make a difference. I know that for a fact. He done something that people don't even realize that he did to help, you know, to help people. But he wasn't looking for recognition for that.
Yeah, with his organization and, you know, digging wells in Africa and
Yeah, getting water clear water for people. Every time he came over to America, he had a shipment that was going back to Africa. You know, a shipment of discarded things that people would discard. Because, you know, those bloods over there in Africa, they take an old computer and old car and turn it into something new, you know. Yeah. And so anyway, he understood this. And he did a lot of things. So, yeah.
Yeah.
May I add a little something to that?
Oh, yeah, please, Halima.
And, of course, you and King know me well enough to know I just reach back and tie a little bit of piece and say, now, you see how this fits in with that? All goes way over here, and this is something else way over there. You know when King mentioned that ripple effect, you might not see it, but when you drop that pedal and it creates those ripples and it go on and on, but if you understand the wider picture, you'll see the effect. Yes, G. Jagger did make a contribution, and he didn't only make an attempt to do something, he succeeded, because in demonstrating what he demonstrated, this encouraged other people to participate in that same fashion.
Yeah,
so
you're
that's
right.
Another ripple. He was not here physically to see certain developments after he passed away, of course, but at the same time that there are many people who highly respect what he did, and they are encouraged by his efforts to continue to contribute in whatever way that they can contribute. So he made a big difference.
Yeah.
Herb, do you want to call any names?
Let's go back have a reputation for organizing. I guess, no, I'm not calling a name right now. Well, I'm dealing with the loss of great organizers that we've had in New Orleans and throughout the nation and the world. I don't see it happening in New Orleans right now. One of the things we had when I was in Houston was the Coalition for Justice, where you could just about make a phone call and bring out 50 people from different organizations because we were a coalition. And we got a lot of people doing different work, but we're not doing it as a unit. And that I see is our downfall. We're not taking the lead from these organizers who could do this. You know, we had Mark FXF, who was a great organizer in the city. It's just not happening. The leaders, the organizers, we're not working together. We're not working together, and I don't even want to say the leaders because there are very few actual leaders in down there, what I think is happening in New Orleans right now. Our leaders and organizers have physically died, and we're allowing some of their spirits to die. We're not acting out in accordance to the work that they did. Leaders, quote unquote leaders, who were dealers and incarcerated, intimidated, are somehow marginalized. They raise their heads up because the beast will chop their heads off as soon as you stick your head out there. So I'm not pleased with what I see going on in New Orleans right now. And when you asked earlier about organizing that I'm doing, I'm working with, like, I work with different organizations. One organization I really do love is Ray, Resurrection After Exoneration, where these brothers are bringing in former incarcerated people. Actually people who've been exonerated, people who've been wrongfully incarcerated, and they're housing them. They're giving them life skills to help prepare them for this outside that they've been actually thrust out in, because someone who's actually served their time for a crime they may or may not have done, but they served their time. They have reentry programs. There's stuff for them to help, and it's not a lot, but there are some things that were set up to help them get ready for the outside. Exonerees, when they're exonerated, they're just put out there. Like King would be a great witness to that, given a check for $10 and a bus ticket home. And now it's up to you to pick up your own. So Resurrection After Exoneration, founded by John Thompson, is a great work in helping these brothers prepare themselves for the outside. And now that they are outside, helping them to survive and trying to give them life training.
Yeah, that's a great organization. And I believe John was on our radio show, was it last year, King?
I think it was last year, yes.
Yeah, and he had a heart attack because, you know, he was in prison for over 20 years, wrongfully convicted, and took over 20 years of, you know, active, legal, filing, you know, against, you know, he has some really good attorneys to keep at it and keep at it and keep at it to finally get him acquitted. But, you know, there's like so many years, it's like, you know, you, King, have spent so many years behind bars, you know, wrongfully convicted. But Walima, I'm glad you're back.
You got knocked clean out of the box.
Yeah, but we're kind of winding down this first part of the program. But I wanted to mention this one of the things that I remember that happened, you know, this month was the Haitian, you know, the beginning of the Haitian Revolution, and New Orleans and Haiti are really closely connected with regards, you know, geographically, and I also want to mention I just pulled up a website called Black Facts, and it talks about specifically August 29th, and it says, and this is selected, and it says that in 1979, on August 29th, the first completely black-owned radio network in the world, called Mutual Black Network, was purchased by Sheridan Broadcasting Corporation. In 1970, there was a racial confrontation on August 29th. One policeman killed and six wounded in a racial confrontation between police and Black Panther activists in Philadelphia. And then in 1962, Mal Good becomes the first African-American television news commentator when he begins broadcasting on ABC. And everyone knows that today Michael Jackson was born in 1958. He would have been 54. In 1957 today, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1957. And the bill established the Civil Rights Commission and the Civil Rights Division and the Justice Department. It also gave the Justice Department authority to seek injunctions against voting rights infractions. And how apropos, right? Like on the 28th is the anniversary of Martin King's I Have a Dream speech, and on the 29th, this act happened, and then we look at how all this is unraveling, going back to earlier parts of our conversation, you know, with, you know, changing the districts, and also making it so that people can't vote. I mean, it's just really horrible what's going on today. And then, and I'll let you come back. I mean, I know you all are going to probably want to talk about some of this. And then in 1929, Dinah Washington was born. And 1920, Charlie Bird Parker was born in Kansas City. And in 1894, sociologist E. Franklin Frazier was born. So that's just today itself, and not to mention the rest of the month. And I know that Harriet Tubman was also born this month.
August is a very exciting month. Of course, all of them are, but if you pinpoint some things, August is a month that a lot of notable activities occurred. And, you know, in the African, as you would say, diaspora.
As I would say. So I was wondering if we could conclude, you know, this wonderful conversation. We're just talking about, you know, the black spirit and the spirit of resistance that, you know, is keeping folks like Malik, who, you know, was with us and had to, you know, go take care of, you know, some business on the block, you know, with his community, since, you know, he is, you know, providing electricity, you know, in that particular area. You know, the spirit of resistance and that keeps, you know, people who like yourselves working and not being discouraged and not taking victories as, you know, reason to go sit down and relax.
You know, Wanda, when you say victory, we've had some successes in New Orleans with some rebuilding. You know, it's not all doom and gloom. But as you said, it's not time to relax. There's so much more work to be done now. When Brother President Barack Obama took office, there was a new cry in the U.S. That cry is, let's take our country back. And that's the fight. You know, they're outraged that they've got this black president in the White House. And we look at, we see every day we see what's going on throughout the U.S. and protest to that. Well, the same thing is happening in New Orleans. You know, we've got City Councilwoman, President of the City Council, Jackie Clarkson, said it's getting to be like the good old days. So the good old days weren't that good for me. You know, what they refer to as the good old days is when they had their boots on our throats. And we started sizing up, and now they're reversing that. They're trying to get it back to out their boots on our throats. What he said is, after the wine and roses, everything's going back to where it used to be. That we can't allow that to happen. There's too many great leaders who step forward. Same thing. We're doing an injustice to them. We allow their work and their lives to go on and allow these people to bring things back to the way it used to be. So, Walima.
Well, when you mentioned Wanda, that spirit, you know, that keeps, you know, black folks resisting, I think that's something innately tied into every living creature that forces it to resist to the best of its ability. Sometimes some individuals have developed to the point that they can resist far greater forces than some others. But then, too, that resistance is innate. So sometimes individuals who may not be able to do much as an individual recognize period of time that when working with unity of purpose, then we can make a difference. And this is what all oppressed people have to learn to do, to draw in a spirit of resistance that demands that the human being not accept oppression or any indignities. So when we see that black resistance is just a natural quality coming out at a time that is so very much needed.
And and we have to be the one to put forward this resistance, because no one else had to do it. And so you see, and so you can see the resistance is so profound and so pronounced, because throughout the eons, throughout the years, if you want to say it like that, we've had to struggle. And so so we have to exhibit this. Other people did not, and the reason why it may not seem as pronouncing maybe other people, because maybe, because they haven't had to struggle as long as we have, and to the degree in which we have. And not that they haven't struggled at all and have to resist, but it is, the resistance is in us because we have to. I think someone said, some are born, it was a poet, I can't think of who it was, said some are born with a silver spoon, with stars strung for a rattle. And in reference to black people, he said, we cut our teeth as a black raccoon for implement a battle. So we come here, we cut our teeth. We come into a world that it was designed to force us to have to struggle. And our struggle is still more pronounced because it was, oppression was heaped upon us in greater amount than on others throughout our history.
Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well, thank you all so much for joining me this morning to talk about the 7th anniversary of the Great Flood. Walimo, did you get a chance to comment?
Yes, I did get a chance to comment.
Okay.
Anything
all
in particular?
Right. Yeah, I was talking about the resistance.
Oh, yes, I commented.
Okay.
I was coming to them because I commented a minute ago about that.
Okay,
right.
Just checking. I might be sleeping over here, 2 hours earlier. I thought that. Just wanted to make sure.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Wanda.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm going to close out our conversation with a piece by this ensemble called Bookman Experience, because, the Hurricane Isaac, and I think I mentioned to King and to some others that, Isaac is my mother's maiden name, so I don't know, I don't remember any hurricanes being named a name that I recognized before, but Isaac, sort of came through, as all of the hurricanes do, they come off the west coast of Africa heading toward, this coast, and it hits the ports where our people came into this hemisphere. So it went through Haiti and, with all the rains and people are still in those camps, so it's really, really miserable there. And then it hit Florida and now it's making its way across, the Gulf regions. And so this ensemble called Bookbond Experience, live at Red Rocks, they've got a piece called, I don't know how to say it in the Creole, but it's called The Day of Revolt. And I thought that'd be a fitting way to close out this particular segment of our talk for this show. And I want to thank all of you so much, and continued blessings and on being safe and staying, above the water, because I know you all are below sea level. You, Walimu and Herb and Malik. When Malik's in a little higher ground, but Herb and Malimu, I think you all are like right there, right?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Yeah. Right. So we'll be thinking about you. I've been thinking about you as the hurricane's been traveling for the past week. And definitely, my thoughts and my prayers are with you presently. And so, since you all decided to, when you don't evacuate,
ride it out.
Ride it out.
Yeah.
Again, it's category one, Wanda. It's I didn't see a reason to evacuate. But yeah, we're where we are, and we're here because we choose to be. And our blessings go out to you and everyone else that's thinking of us. I let you know, for the most part, we're all right. No, we're going to be all right.
Okay, cool.
No doubt about it.
All right.
All
well,
right.
You all take care.
All right. All right. All right, Wanda. All right. Good. All right. Wally, Moo. Talk to you all.
Good. Wanda.
All right.
Okay,
peace to all.
Okay, peace.
All right.
That's my beautiful brother. That's my beautiful sister. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
You're welcome, man.
The day of the reborn. God was shy. Ça fait longtemps y a des gens pour nous vivre. Pendant un temps, la couleur puis tomber les allées. Nous vendons rosé.
Nous
ne vendons. Moment arrivé pour faire une avec les filles. C'est pour nous, c'est pour nous, mon dingue. C'est ça, on a dit son pensée, c'est ça, on a fait du petit pour en harmonie. Revolte.
And Haiti, we call it Rara. You see? And the voodoo we bring there is not voodoo. What the Hollywood talking about, you see? With sting, puppet, that kind of thing. To make people, to divide people, to make people afraid to know, to know what's going on there. But now, it's voodoo. Because it's spirit. Voodoo means spirit. There's something going on. And that's something we have to keep it. That's why. We don't come here like that. Because tomorrow something is going to happen. You know, there's war now. There's war now. Now there's war. We have to really... I don't know how to say. Okay, let's go to...
That was Bukuman Experience live at Red Rocks. And I don't know if anyone has seen this marvelous ensemble, but this was a birthday present for me from my beloved friend, Pierre Labossière. One of the founders of Haiti Action Committee, and they're just doing some really good work, keeping the fire under the feet of this government and keeping Haiti on the minds of all of our people. And, you know, without outside of Haiti, that is. This is a really wonderful piece, and that was, I don't know how to say it in Creole, but the piece was called The Day of the Revolt, and that's referencing the uprising where Africans, under the leadership of Bukuman and Mam Fatiman, declared no more enslavement. And the lyrics go, the day of the revolt is the day we will revolt. The day has arrived for us to start a revolution, to stop copying from other nations. For so long, they have told us how to live during the time. Uh-oh. Don't know what that is. Uh-oh. I think I'm still online. Oh, my goodness. I get mixed up sometimes. Shoot. Wow. I'm not certain if I was on the air or not. I'm gonna play another song and just in case. and check this out really quickly. So here's Bukuman Experience again, performing. They've got a drum piece that's really, really cool. And so we're going to play that really quickly, and then it's about 2 minutes, and then we're going to go on to another piece. Oh, wait. wrong piece. Oops. Oh, here we are. Yes, Manding drumming.
We're going to dance one of the rhythm of Haiti we took from the Manding, community of Balan in the north of Haiti. We're going to dance Haiti with their rhythm.
Now 8 years old, she was six when they did the filming. And and I'm not sure how to pronounce this child's name, Kuvanzane Wallace, and she plays Dwight Henry's character, Wink's child, and Kuvanzane, her character's name is Hush Puppy, and she actually tells the story, and about the people that they lived in a particular area of the Gulf, right outside of outside of New Orleans, called the Bathtub, and it's a really, really beautiful film, and I don't know if people have seen it, but today would be a great day to go see such a film if you're in, you know, not in New Orleans and in the diaspora. I'm going to read my review of this film. It's called Life Cycles, a review of Beasts of the Southern Wild, and as I mentioned, it's currently in San Francisco at the Landmark Embarcadero, and it's in Berkeley as well, and it might be in Oakland, but I'm not certain. Beasts of the Southern Wild, directed by Ben Zetlin, is a lyrical film about a community in the southern part of Louisiana Gulf Coast called the Bathtub. Surrounded by water, this little island is cut off from the mainland more than just physically. It is a philosophical separation that makes its people look suspiciously at what those on the mainland see as normal. Inherent in their lives is a respect for all living beings. The line between childhood and adulthood doesn't exist, as a father teaches his daughter to be tough, so tough she has her own house, which she burns down on purpose. The two even share a drink when the child, who is supposed to be tough, and tough means to accept life without tears, the two break down. The kid is, after all, a child, perhaps 8, maybe younger. And she is younger. She's 6, as I find out. Later on, I actually had a conversation with Mr. Henry, because he was going to try to join us, but one of the publicists suggested that, you know, since people are without electricity, that he should probably save his cell phone, you know, for emergencies, and I certainly agree with that. But he was telling me that President Obama was recently speaking with Oprah Winfrey, and I don't know if he was on her show or not, and he told her, he asked her, had she seen the film Beast of the Southern Wild, and she hadn't heard of the film. And so she invited Mr. Henry and the child actress and the director on to her home and filmed a special, which aired this past weekend. You probably saw it. I didn't see it, but I heard it was a really good experience. And so he and I were speaking yesterday. I guess that was Tuesday morning. He called me because he's a baker in New Orleans, and I've been trying to reach him because my mother told me about the film. She gets the paper in Southern California. It's a black paper called The Wave, and sends them to me. And I hadn't heard of this great film. It's really interesting. The director, the film is actually supported by the Art University. See, what is it? The Art Academy University collaborates with him on the film. The San Francisco Film Society is a part of this film production. So I'm thinking, wow, how did I happen to not know about this film? So anyway, I'm real happy that my mother clipped the review and interview it with Mr. Henry and sent it to me so that I could know about it and go see it, because it was certainly a magnificent experience. And so I was speaking to Mr. Henry, and he said that he had been in the San Francisco Bay Area. He had been to Lucas Studios and Pixar, and you know, they're all like Bay Area stuff, Bay Area entities, they were at Sundance, and they won lots of awards there, and they traveled internationally. And he said he's been to Los Angeles about 5 times in about a couple of months, so he's, you know, definitely making, you know, a lot of tours, he and his co-star. And they actually have another film that they both are in, and it looks at enslavement and of our people and resistance to that. And so I'm really looking forward to that coming out. So we're going to actually have an interview with him when it's dry and everything has settled down a bit. But I just wanted to mention that I got a chance to speak to him yesterday, and that was really exciting. So back to my review. The writing of this film, Beast of the Southern Wild, the writing is, oh my goodness, Ben Zetland's writing is what gets the audience. The externalized thoughts of this little girl, Hush Puppy, who speaks to a mother who is no longer present, a dad who is sick, and we find out later dying. When Hurricane Katrina comes, the folks in the bathtub don't evacuate. They make plans, which are in constant flux. Like life, they roll with the tides, and when rescued, they leave. Wild containment is not something they are used to. When learning about the melting glaciers and the prehistoric animals that walked the planet before us, Hush Puppy is able to have a meditative acceptance of life as it cycles, sunrise, day, sunset. The interchange between the beast, whose nature is survival, juxtaposed with that of the human species, who are also beasts, Hush Puppy's teacher tells her students, yet with a twist. The wild boars might eat their kin if hungry enough, but for the tribe Hush Puppy belongs to, it never comes to that. She does say, when her dad disappears, that she might have to start eating her friends if he doesn't return soon. He does return, that is, dressed in a hospital gown. One never quite knows what is on Wink's mind, except he loves Hush Puppy and loved her mother, a mystery we never quite solve. While watching the lazy, luscious film, it reminded me rhythmically of Julie Dash's Daughters of the Dust. The lyrical quality of the film also comes through as well. It was Dash's pen and palette that created this landscape, along with exceptional... Oh, actually, it's not Dash, sorry. That's a mistake. It was Zetland's pen and palette that created this luscious, this landscape, along with exceptional co-stars, the three women. Oh, no, actually, no, I was right. It is Dash. I'm talking about Daughters of the Dust. I'm talking about Daughters of the Dust, and so... Julie Dash's pen and palette that created this landscape, along with exceptional co-stars, the three women, among them Barbara Oh. In Beast, it is Kuvanzani Wallace and Dwight Henry, neither actors before this illustrious debut, who make the illusion tangible. This beauty is also enhanced, I'm sure, in the technical presence of Art Academy University and the San Francisco Film Society. Shot on location in Louisiana and its Ninth Ward, one sees the levee breached. I see an editorial side. Whenever I think about the Art Academy University, it leaves a bitter taste in my mouth, odor in my nostrils. Its president is responsible for Lorraine Hansberry Theater's displacement and subsequently its founder's death. Okay, she didn't kill them, but they might have lived longer if they hadn't experienced this loss. Okay, that's the aside. Perhaps what is so remarkable is how natural the actors appear with one another. The mixed-race community is a few families large, but though isolated, they are not aware of what life is like outside the bathtub island they created for their families. Who are the beasts, one might ask of herself after the film? The people who plug their sick into a wall, or the people who teach their children to fly? There are so many picturesque scenes. Almost all the ones with Hush Puppy in them are keepers. The memory of her father holding her as a baby, juxtaposed with that of a woman holding her and dancing, is one. The other is when she cooks a meal with a blowtorch, and the final is when Hush Puppy talks to the mammoth boars. It's pretty remarkable. Oh, and one more. When Hush Puppy sits buried in crayfish shells, they are like having a crayfish feast. Another beautiful moment is Hush Puppy's creation story, the story of her parents' first meeting, where everything falls away except their attraction for one another. The spunky child is pretty remarkable, as is her dad. Her life illustrates the fact that it is best if we tell our children the truth. Wink and Hush Puppy's lives are what they are because of this. Hush Puppy tells her father that if he dies, her life will be over. He tells her that she will live much longer than he will, and that is when she cries. In the end, they are both crying. Hush Puppy listens to heartbeats in leaves, birds, hogs, and other human beings. She knows this is life's rhythm as she lies down next to her dad's heart one more time. So again, I highly recommend this beautiful film. And I'm going to play another Bookman experience. I think we're going to feature them today, except for that one piece by, this one's called Ancestors, and I think it's really apropos. Our ancestors, I should say.
We're going to study the ancestors from Africa, from America, from Chelsea, from India, all positive vibrations to help us. Santa
Congo, Congo, by another.
You see how beautiful? Wow. Yes. Oh, I'm glad to be here. All right.
That's Bookman Experience. And I was going to close the show with another piece about ancestors. And this is from Upsurge's Chromatology. And Upsurge Jazz and Music Ensemble, they are leaving the San Francisco Bay Area. They are moving away. It's like, wow, that's going to be quite a void created by their movement because, Upsurge was born here in Berkeley, you know, where Raymond Nat Turner, its founder, lived for so long and, raised his children here in the Bay Area. He always talks about, his children, being students at the Oakland Community School, the school of the Black Panther Party. And, and his son, doctor, has a doctorate and doing so much good work. And, so it's going to be really something not having them here anymore. So going to play this piece. It's called Ancestors. And for those who know the group, you might know this particular piece, and I'm looking for it right now to play it, and not seeing it just yet. Oh, here we go. Upsurge, nope. Trying to remember, sometimes like, what is my alphabet? No, that's not it. But I think I'll play Vijay Iyer's Action Speak, and then I'll come back to Ancestors, and we're going to close out with that. And I am heading to Oregon on Friday, so we're going to have another early show. It's not going to be 8 o'clock our regular time. We're going to have a little earlier, and we're going to be featuring interviews with Karen Allison, who's going to be in town at the Raz Room this weekend. It's going to really be phenomenal in a pre-recorded interview. And we're also going to be featuring an interview with Jacqueline Stewart, who is one of the curators of this wonderful film series, L.A. Rebellion, Creating a New Black Cinema, that's going to be a part is in collaboration with Pacific Film Archives. And it's having its Northern California debut, which is wonderful. And the first of the films but it's going to be screening at Pacific Film Archives on UC Berkeley campus September 6th. And it goes for over a month. The concluding screenings are October 30th, so it's going to be really great. And the dates vary, Thursday, September 6th, and then the following week, Thursday, September 13th, and then there's a Wednesday screening, and then there's going to be a Tuesday screening. So you definitely want to get the schedule. Just go to UC Berkeley Pacific Film Archive.edu and definitely plug that into your calendar. You don't want to miss any of these films because they're rarely shown, and quite a few of them have been restored, and so it's just really phenomenal. So here we are, Vijay Iyer's Action Speak, and then we're going to play the piece by Upsurge. And they're going to be having a concert, a going-away concert, so stay tuned for that. And I'll definitely include it in my Wanda's Pick September 2012, so you can visit the website for the information. So that was B.J. Iyer. And his piece, Action Speak. And I was just looking, sort of unpacking some boxes in my office at work, and I ran across, sort of really amazingly, two Newsweek cover stories about Katrina in 2005. The first one is dated September 12th, and it says, "Pray for us, horror in New Orleans, the relief fiasco." And there's a mother clutching a baby in one arm and another baby in the other arm with some water and in her hands, and then there's water on the streets. And the other one is dated September 19th, also 2005, just a week later, and it says, "Poverty, Race, and Katrina: Lessons of a National Shame." And that one's by Jonathan Alter. And just remember the way that African people were denied their or robbed of their citizenship, you know, being called refugees. And so anyway, just sort of looking back in history, and 7 years later, not much has changed. It's a lot of work to do still. So I'm going to play Ancestors for those who did not survive and for those whose legacy keeps us moving forward and whose strength we call on often. So this is Upsurge's Ancestors from Chromatology.
Ancestor, let me be your drum tonight. Speak through me. Ancestors, let me be your drum tonight. Speak through me. Bestow me with elephant ears. Allow me to see.
Bird said, "See with your ears and hear with your eyes." Bird said, "See with your ears and hear with your eyes."
Ancestors, let me be your well tonight, flowing cool and clear. Ancestors, let me be your well tonight, flowing cool and clear. Bestow me with eagle's eye. Allow me to hear.
Bird says, "See with your ears and hear with your eye." Bird said, "See with your ears and hear with your eye."
I on the prize.
Again, we ride.
Concert is going to be happening on September 28th, about a month from today, at the Freight and Savage in Berkeley, 2020 Addison in Berkeley. Alrighty, thank you so much for joining us for another edition of Wanda's Picks. And again, on Friday, the last day of Black August, the 31st, we're going to be broadcasting a little bit earlier, so stay tuned, about 4 o'clock in the morning Pacific time. And you know we're available on iTunes as well as on the website. Peace and blessings.